This is Melissa, and today is the 6th of April, 2025, and I hope you're all doing well. Wednesday of last week, I took a road trip, had a bit of an adventure, and I'll share that with you later. But I did want to tell you about some listening that I did on my drive. And that was to a talk that Alan gave, a blurb, on July the 4th, 2007. And I picked this primarily because of some things that he was talking about that I wanted to hear again because of personal things that I'm going through in my own thought process. But as it turned out, I felt that the talk really tied in beautifully and might even be a good kickoff talk to the Waiting for the Miracle book club and discussion. So I have used this before as a redux back in April, about the 10th of April, I think I looked it up. So the 10th of April of 2022. So it's been a full 3 years now since I played it. And I listened to it 3 times on Wednesday, so I think a little repetition is okay. It's a very good talk. I remember that Adam I've spoken with before on Real History. He's from New Zealand and lives in Germany, longtime listener to Alan, and I think he told me that this was about his favorite of Alan's blurbs. And I can understand why, because it is one that is in the mode of delivery of my personal favorite, Sing Your Song and Steal Some Time, in that Alan is very relaxed. There are long pauses where sometimes you think maybe the audio stopped, but he's in no rush to deliver his thoughts, and there's such profound, amazing insights, as well as a lot of history. So I ended up listening to it 3 times on this drive. I got a lot out of it. And I decided that I would share it with you again today, but I think I'm splitting it in half. So I will be playing the second half with different thoughts and different things that I'm highlighting next week. Like I say, it will be a good starting point for extra background for the Waiting for the Miracle discussion. So the title of this is Modern Mythological Enemies versus the Man in the Mirror, Psychological Projection in the Scientific Era. So Alan starts off the talk by the way that our perceptions are really influenced by our indoctrination, our education, our own experiences, and this is how we reach our conclusions. So we can only come to the conclusions with what has gone into our mind. And Alan said, well, I'll just read a little bit. You'll hear it again, but like I said, there's no harm in repeating things. He said, tonight, I'd like to talk about perceptions and logic and how we arrive at what we think are our conclusions. Conclusions are reached through comparing personal experience, education, indoctrination, learned behavior against new events, really. The trouble with this type of arrival at the conclusion is that if the erroneous indoctrinations are to the front, and if the current trends of the day, which are often massive propaganda, are to the fore, we will often arrive, or we will arrive often, he said, at someone else's erroneous conclusion. He talks about disinformation, the world of purposely leading us to the wrong conclusion. And he then talks later on in this first half that I'm playing for you about the third eye, your third eye. And he said, the ancients wrote about the mind. The third eye is very simple. As the exoteric people delve into what they think are mysteries, looking for pineal glands and other methods of stimulating the pineal gland and opening up a pathway, and knowledge will just flood into them. And Alan said, you earn knowledge by examining yourself, because all knowledge ultimately must be within. It's a sad state when we look around us and see that in many, many people, all they have is extraneous knowledge given to them, often misunderstood, misquoted, going from the simplistic to the bizarre. The mind is the third eye, because all perceptions ultimately must be deciphered by the mind of the person. So he goes into a bit of a discussion about the serpent and the uraeus. The uraeus is the cobra that was worn on the head of the pharaohs, the ruling elite from Egypt. And he said that the cobra or the serpent represents knowledge. And also, because the cobra was lightning quick, it would strike if you dared to come between, you know, to try to enter into the mind of the person who was wearing that emblem of knowledge. So sometimes when we look at symbols, we look on a kind of simplistic level and we think serpent bad, you know, serpent delivers knowledge, Eve takes this, she's not supposed to have it, you know, they go out of the garden, or a variety of ways that we see serpents. But in this way, Alan was talking about those who deemed themselves to have the right to protect their third eye, their own mind. And the commoner did not have that right. The commoner had to allow any indoctrination, any programming, any bizarre or ridiculous or logical fallacy had to come into their mind, because this was the technique of control. But the ruling elite, the pharaohs, their class, were protected from that. They guarded their third eye. And so one of the things that I was thinking about in listening to that is how important it is that we understand what is out there and why it's out there. And what I'm talking about when I say out there is a whole range of things that create the system that we live in. So out there is your education, and out there is your religion. Out there is the media and fiction or nonfiction indoctrination. Out there are the heroes that we are given, that we're supposed to worship. Let's just say, for instance, in our time, that might be Donald Trump or Elon Musk, or you get what I'm saying. And I mean, I think it depends on where you are. But what one thing that is interesting to me is how closely many people in different parts of the world follow U.S. political theater. And that's out there. So what Alan is saying is, You earn knowledge by examining yourself, because all knowledge ultimately must be within. And he talks about what Christianity in particular, but other religions and the cargo cults. And that's an interesting thing there, where you might call it naive or perhaps primitive or whatever, but people, islanders, had Westerners living there during the war, World War II. And I think some of the cargo cult thinking predates that. But there were suddenly, because of this Western influence there, there were things that money could buy. So there were parts of a system that were never these people's system. And when the U.S. evacuated, pulled out, they left, they no longer needed to have an airstrip there or a base or whatever they had there, the people missed those goods and the things that had been brought to them or given to them or introduced to them by the Westerners, by the U.S. And so they began to worship the sky and these sky birds or the planes that might come back and, you know, return again with these goods and material for them. And Alan is telling us about religion and the function that it serves, that it's always a handmaiden, if you will, or the right arm of the system. And he said about Christianity, the Christian religion was never a reality. He said, I didn't say the message was never a reality, but the religion was never a reality. The message was supposed to free individuals from what was a mass culture of rigid indoctrination. And one thing that I have noticed over the years are the kind of fanciful things. Sometimes they're kind of bizarre, but they are based on a kind of, well, what Alan here calls possibility thinking, imagination. What if? Or if we believe this, then this is possible. And so he was talking about this specifically with like ancient alien, the kind of stuff of science fiction, technology, Chariots of the Gods, von Daniken, and what he said that Quigley described as the symptoms of the ages. And that's where values that belong to another age are still being held onto. And really, I think that that's what we're living through right now, all around us, because it has been decided that we're moving into a new age. And so we'll have a new religion that goes with that new age. But many people haven't caught up to that yet, because the indoctrination, the depopulation, all of the things that go along with ushering in the new age, they are playing out at different rates or different speeds depending on where you are. And so what we have is a little bit of chaos and a little bit of people searching for answers and reaching and saying, okay, that's it. It's this dark energy. It's entities. It's this kind of Christianity is the only right path. And what you think is not right because you're not reading the right version of the Bible, or, you know, and it goes on and on. And it's not just Christianity. I mean, it's everything, because, like I said, new age is being ushered in. And I was thinking about cargo cults and QAnon and cargo cults and Elon Musk, and I let a lot of different combinations run around in my head. And, you know, as I was kind of diving into just, you know, a few little hunts here and there out there to see, oh, well, has anybody else come upon this? Well, a lot of people have written about what they observe on an organizational level of what you might call a magical thinking that creeps into an institution when it has started to decay. And you might even think of an institution as your civilization. So when you have that kind of decay, you have this magical thinking. It exhibits in a variety of ways. So yes, I did find other people writing about that, and that was interesting. And I didn't find anything that I thought you needed to read. I may post an article or two, but I'm not really endorsing it. It's just, I'm not endorsing it because I think even who you might think of as good thinkers, you know, there's a lot of confusion in their thinking because, as Alan would say, they're really only writing and talking and thinking based on their own education, indoctrination, learned behavior, etc. And so people that we might say, oh, well, they're smart, they've got a good education, they're just as apt to be arriving at an erroneous conclusion as anyone else. But one thing that I stumbled on, there's just a little line in there where the writer was talking about Yuval Noah Harari, and the title of the piece and why I stumbled on it was Harari's Algorithmic Cargo Cult. And so I started reading it, and you know, there were some interesting things I didn't agree with. But this writer quoted one of Harari's so-called mantras. The idea is that AI can achieve feats way beyond human capacity without consciousness. And so one of Harari's mantras is, intelligence has become decoupled from consciousness. And that gave me some pause, because at the beginning of Waiting for the Miracle, at the very first interview, when Alan and Jackie started to talk, Jackie asked Alan, how would you define full consciousness? And Alan said, the truth, knowing the truth. The truth is the hardest thing to define. And then he goes out there to talk about how the public is given history and it's somebody else's story, etc. But if you take Alan's definition, that consciousness is the truth, then it is an interesting thing to think about Harari's mantra being intelligence has become decoupled from consciousness. And I'll reword that. Intelligence has become decoupled from truth. So whether intelligence is natural or artificial, if it is decoupled from truth, it is not useful to us. And the reason, I guess, that I wanted to, as I said last week, really move my focus so that much of the work that I do in some way comes back to the Waiting for the Miracle discussion is because of something that I read in the fifth interview of the first part of Waiting for the Miracle. Jackie and Alan were talking, and Alan recommended that Jackie read a book entitled The Golden Bough. The Golden Bough, A Study in Magic and Religion by Sir James George Frazer. And Jackie said, I have the book. I haven't gotten through Plato's Republic, The Republic yet, Alan. And Alan said, "Hurry up, because time is running out. We've got about 30 years left." And so I read that not very long ago, and I was thinking, well, my goodness, this interview was in 1998, and it is 2025. And if he was telling Jackie that she had about 30 years for people to get up to speed, we've got about 3 years now. And I don't want to get stuck in what is this? Is it total censorship of the internet, a total blackout on our ability to communicate with one another? Is it a cataclysm? Is it a coming ice age? Nor will I say that Alan ever thought that he was going to nail something down to the day, the hour, the minute, nothing like that. But those of you who've listened long to him and read his work understand that he had a pretty clear view of the future. And so if he said in 1998, we've got about 30 years left, that really hits me in 2025. And so I want to stay focused on those things that I think are the most important that Alan brought to us, that we must know ourselves, really know ourselves. We cannot any longer be victims. We cannot any longer be innocent of our own culpability in this. We've all been victimized by being born into a system that was created for us, but let's not wallow in that. We must be our own champions. But it's not out there. We all need to be developing our own internal fortitude, our own internal third eye, looking within, trusting ourselves, not looking outside for some other explanation, because that will land us in a cargo cult. And that kind of magical waiting chariots of the gods, it's going to be supplied for us endlessly as we transition from one age into the next. So I leave you with that. I will just say really quickly that I've got a little bit of a promo that I'm doing on the Waiting for the Miracle books. If you get them along with the audio that goes with it, whether it is in the flash drive portion or on the two CDs that comprise the audio portion of these interviews, there is a limited time. I don't know yet how limited the time is, but I have reduced the price on that for you. And there are a few of you who recently purchased the book just in the last few weeks, and I'll try to be sure to get you your audio component at that reduced price if that's something that you're interested in, because this just occurred as a thing to do and I don't want you to feel left out. Thanks. And I'm also going to try to post the syllabus with this talk for the first section. And that by the syllabus, it just means some extra things that I thought might be useful to you if you want to read them, view them, listen to them. And that includes some talks from Alan as well that just supplement the understanding. What I'm saying is, I agree with Alan, time is short. And it is time for those of us who are serious students and seekers of truth, that is consciousness, not decoupled from our own intelligence. It's time for us to really put the focus where it does us the most good. And I wish you all a good week and enjoy this first part of the talk from Alan Watt. Thank you.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com, You can also find me at Alan Watt Sentient Sentinel and a few other sites. You probably have noticed that when you punch into the com site, you'll be diverted to other main sites I have. And this is because so many people across the world are now downloading lots of the information I've given out, and it's spreading like wildfire. Today is July the 4th, 2007. Tonight I'd like to talk about perceptions and logic and how we arrive at what we think are our conclusions. Conclusions are reached through comparing personal experience, education, indoctrination, learned behavior against new events, really. The trouble with this type of arrival at the conclusion is that if the erroneous indoctrinations are to the front, and if the current trends of the day, which are often massive propaganda, are to the fore, we will arrive often at someone else's erroneous conclusion. We do live in a world of mass disinformation. Mass disinformation, which sometimes is put out on purpose, other times it's done by people who themselves have been caught up in erroneous conclusions. And always remember, because something is said often, doesn't mean it's true. We have a tremendous tendency to go into the past, and this is a happening, an occurrence that happens towards the end of an age. Philosophers and historians know this. They know that when you go through history from very early times and you see the rising of what they call civilizations, which really is a form of moneyed commerce rule, with the creation of armies and the building of ultimately empires, and then watching those things which occur when empires crumble and fall. Empires tend to crumble and fall when they run out of enemies. Then there is tremendous class warfare. The class warfare always ends up with an elite and a middle class, which is really the helpers of the elite, trying to eradicate, eliminate the lower classes through standard methods which keep getting repeated down through history. When Rome fell, for instance, the Roman Empire, it wasn't simply a matter of invasions from outside. The Roman Empire lived, like all empires ultimately do, on massive taxations, not of only of their own people, but of the conquered countries they had gone into. When they reach a zenith, the peak of their power, they then begin to degenerate through massive corruption. And greed is addictive. There's never enough. It's like cocaine. The first high is the best, supposedly, and everything else is on a dwindling scale, regardless of the quantity they use. Greed is the same, so is the hype for sexual fulfillment. It becomes deviant during the deviant period of the downfall. But Rome also fell because it had taxed all of its dominions, the conquered countries, into utter poverty in order that the ultra-elite in Rome could not only continue at a high standard of living, but go into utterly amazing perversions of what we would term luxury, ever expanding massive pools and idol making just for admiring at parties and that kind of thing. Big shows, massive parties. That was part of the reason it fell. Part of the reason it fell too was that they taxed the rural peoples who supplied them with everything they needed, food, materials, items which were made and so on. They all went into the city, which technically produces nothing except debt and ultimately perversions in its later stages. And the rural peoples rose up to help finish it off when they had enough. They had no choice in the matter. These sequences are always repeated down through ages. And yet the elite of each period don't perish. They move. Very often they move before the country or the city in which they reside falls, and they've already set up the next beginning, the embryo of the next empire. Now, you'll hear me on shows where people go into reptilians and all this kind of thing, where they take allegories as fact and become mixed up with it all. Because people tend ultimately to go into religion, which again they take as fact, and even some who understand as esoteric meanings involved and allegorical meanings involved, they also still go back and take some of the exoteric, because their minds try to compare information to something from the past. And we often think the past must be true if we just get an ultimate history on something, but no, or an ultimate religion or the first language, etc. We tend to think that somehow the secret is in the past. Now, the secrets of deception certainly are in the past, and much of it can be uncovered if you do a diligent search through history. But even the ancient historians of Greece and other countries had to admit that they didn't have all of the information of any beginning. The same went for the religion makers in early Judaism, and going into even the Talmud. Then the Talmud really was begun in Babylon and continued. But they had to admit that no one could know God. What they meant by that was no one could describe God. Any description would be human attributes put onto something which was beyond the human. There's a truth in there, because humans would tend to, if they could, always create a god in their own image, something which they could relate to. That's why on the exoteric level of the New Testament or the Old Testament, you have a deity that's kind of like an angry father, something human which they could relate to, with rules and laws for children. It isn't until you come to the Hellenized version or Christianity, where they brought in other attributes from a Hellenic world. Now, the Hellenic world, the Greek world, at that period, they came in with Alexander the Great, brought with it an opposing side of the Yahweh God, that the sometimes unstable father figure. And they brought in a feminine side too, because they had female gods as well, which were very popular back in ancient Greece, with the Alma Mater and so on. Therefore, in the New Testament, you have a deity which still has laws and rules, but there's a loving side to this God and a forgiving side, whereas the Old Testament God seems to be rather severe in judgments. Religion has always been used to control the minds of people, and it's only the very rare individual who can see through the exoteric to understand the esoteric, because there certainly is wisdom in all old religions on an esoteric level. And the wisdom is always to do, always on an esoteric journey, to do with an individual's journey themselves. That's why you would relate to it. The mass man or woman happens to be gregarious. Gregarious people like to group together and conform. Conformity means you give up individuality in the group. That is why groups that are religious tend to be very severe themselves. They take on a persona of the judgmental God. They don't like differences. They become fixed and set in their ways. They will have benefits for members. They will have help and aid for those in distress within the group. Although even those who are in help and distress within the group can be an embarrassment, because the deity is supposed to bless in a materialistic way. This is how they see things, especially in Christianity today and Judaism. The deity is supposed to bless someone, and that's one of the signs of blessing, is that you're prosperous, you do well, you appear to be happy. Most of them are not happy, because they go through the same dysfunctional situations in relationships, especially with man and wife, as everyone else in modern day society. The ancients wrote about the mind. The third eye is very simple. As the exoteric people delve into what they think are mysteries, looking for pineal glands and other methods of stimulating the pineal gland and opening up a pathway, that a knowledge will just flood into them. You earn knowledge by examining yourself, because all knowledge ultimately must be within. It's a sad state when we can look around us and see that in many, many people, all they have is extraneous knowledge given to them, often misunderstood, misquoted, going from the simplistic to the bizarre. The mind is the third eye, because all perceptions ultimately must be deciphered by the mind of the person. That is why a trick of rulers in all ages and priesthoods, who taught this to even pharaohs, was that they could alter the perceptions of slaves and vast conquered peoples by getting between the mind of the person and their perceptions. Therefore, their conclusions would be faulty, purposely made so. This was done through early indoctrination into superstitions. when the mind tried to formulate conclusions, the indoctrination would kick in, and they'd compare the new experiences to these indoctrinations and come to faulty conclusions, which kept them enslaved and obedient. The serpent is an allegory for wisdom. Wisdom for what? The Egyptians wore the aureus, the cobra, on a band, a headband. The cobra sat in the forehead, the third eye. The idea being, and that is also a pun between the eyes and idea, the idea being that you are to guard your mind, being a one who was wise and born into a wise family or class, an educated family or class, you would have wisdom. I've gone into the fact that primarily these high families were psychopathic in origin and interbred, and therefore kept the knowledge to themselves, because psychopaths must always try and gain power, total power over everyone else. That's our dilemma in this world. But the serpent strikes, and when it strikes, ancient people used to wonder, why would it let so many people pass a particular route or road or track and only strike the occasional person here or there? In other words, when anyone got too near to it, too near is the key, it would strike and defend itself. An idea being that they used the serpent or the cobra, which had this lightning strike, to strike something it didn't want to come near it. They used that around the headband as a symbol that they would strike anything which tried to enter on unauthorized into their mind. It guarded the mind. The people around did not have the right to wear the aureus, because they were the ruled. In fact, it was mandatory that they be open for all indoctrination, all erroneous teachings, superstition, and so on. The psychopath is so well understood as far as observation goes. So much has been written upon their personalities, their traits, their categories of them, that there's no real need to go into it in any great detail. The snake also had been observed in ancient times to shed its skin every so often. And to the ancients, they thought that therefore the snake was immortal. It was born again as it dropped off the old and had a new body, they thought. Therefore, it was a symbol of immortality. And when the aureus was worn on the headband, not only did it guard the temple, the upper room, the mind, but it also had what they called the wisdom of the ages, meaning the person who wore it had been initiated into and taught the histories and the sciences of the time. The sciences generally were to do with the mastery and the control of the minds of others, the vast populations. That they are psychopathic, there's no doubt. You can see the traits down through history, even to the extent where kings or princes would try and kill their fathers to take over and gain the power. That was fairly common. We don't find that all through society. We find it mainly in the upper noble families, if you go into their histories, in all countries. A king was in a precarious position. He generally was psychopathic himself, since we're all inbred and you take on the traits of special selection, where your mates with the same traits are bred with you. You just like animals, like Plato said, you can breed traits in or out. And when powerful people breed together, you're breeding the same traits in of power and the seeking and lust for power. Therefore, the kings were guarded, and had to pay the guards very well, high bribes, knowing that the queen, who might want her son to take over, or herself to take over, would do all she could to bribe those guards with more, and perhaps poison him or kill him in some other way. Because they lived in such a state of paranoia, they were paranoid about everything, including all of those around them that they ruled over. Therefore, when there were grumblings amongst the people because the elite were taking too much from them, the paranoia would become incredibly acute, and purges would be done on the people. They'd be killed or thinned out, culled to an extent, back to a manageable level. And in ancient times they did surveys, population surveys. You find that again in old religious books and so on, that the people were all numbered, because every so often they had to make sure they had enough guards, well paid, well fed military. Today it's military and police, to do their bidding automatically when they're told to, instant obedience, when they turned them on the people, if it should reach a magic number, because they knew how many of the population on a percentage basis could be managed by each particular guard. They knew and did surveys on this in ancient times. Therefore, when the population went over a certain number, they'd either start a war with a neighbour to start culling them off by enforcing them into the military, or else they'd turn their military on the people. This was standard down through history. Population control is nothing new at all, and it's run by the psychopath, who is also very paranoid. A special position and privilege, especially when you're feeding off everyone else, would make a person paranoid. The psychopath also has a trait of living on their own ego. They're egocentric completely. They don't feel guilt. They will rationalize any act which they may do, even if the rationalization sounds completely bizarre to normal people. Down through the centuries, as empires grew and faded and moved to begin their embryonic new empire somewhere else, always with a goal and always with the knowledge, especially written about since the 1400s and 1500s, they knew they would reach a point because he employed the experts of their day, always, the philosophers, the scribes, and people who did statistics. They did that all along down through history, statisticians, to keep control over everything. But they knew they'd reach a point of global conquest. In the 1700s, many of the elite of Europe, the whole of Europe, met together in what we would term global meetings of the period to discuss saving themselves, making sure that their own offspring would still be in charge 200-300 years down the road. They discussed the problems they foresaw. What they did was to bring in many professors from universities. This has been standard right up to the present time. Not just any professor, but the best in their field. Mainly to do with philosophy, sociology, ethnologies, all the experts, we'd say, to build think tanks which would work for them and keep their fingers on the pulse of the people at all times. We find the big authors in history and philosophy were employed by, in ancient times, kings and queens, and now they're employed by big government agencies. Carol Quigley, who selected people for Rhodes scholarships for world government, and who actually promoted and picked Bill Clinton and put him forward, and others, talked about this in his book Tragedy and Hope. And what he writes in that book really is a type of lecture he'd give to these government agencies when they would call him in. He had high clearance to very top agencies of government, these unelected agencies, and the military industrial complex, and the State Department, the Foreign Affairs Department of the US. Britain had theirs too. They'd pull in one of the most famous being Arnold Toynbee. Now, these people also had psychopathic traits. They could therefore advise how society was going, the problems that they could foresee, and ways, by using historical past techniques, that this could be thwarted or offset or squashed or diverted. Quigley goes into what he calls the symptoms of ages in that book, where they go through a period of rural farming, etc., which is the only real moral period of a nation's history. Then into the city-state creation, where they still retain the values that came from the agricultural society, and then the city-state becomes set on conquest, the age of imperialism. And then when its conquests are over, because they've conquered most of what they can get, they go into a period of recline and decline. They go into bizarre behaviours sexually, with extravagances, and also with deviances of all kinds, as they have orgies of spending and parties. And of course this all comes from taxation, so they're in decline. But they also go through towards the end periods of being unable to defend themselves. initially they try to do all they can, they put all their money into weaponry and getting bigger armies and trying to threaten anyone around them, even though they're the ones attacking them. They then turn this inwards on the people and start to cull them off because they realise that those down below are the ones who bear the burden of all taxation, which is the wealth of the elite. Then they start culling them off. They become paranoid of the people down below. Standard. But they also go through periods of fear, tremendous fear at this stage, and they bring back ancient, what they call ancient superstitions and bizarre thinking. We find always a resurgence back into nature worship as people have no more faith in the old gods. They go into nature worship and pantheism. They also go into the prevalent sciences of that period and will relate and almost fix on ancient beliefs onto the new sciences. Today we see it, since we live in an age of science and space exploration, as we're told, although most of it really is just to do with putting satellites up there which will control us all on planet Earth under the guise of exploration. Today we find that all the stuff of science fiction, which you remember is called fiction, science fiction, is wrapped in with old religions, and we have this bizarre outcome where people try to look at something such as a Nephilim, attach it onto space beings, which cannot look like us because obviously it comes from somewhere else, so they're different, so you have reptilians and all this kind of stuff. And this is what happens at the end of an age, as people desperately try to rationalize the position that they're in and what they're facing. You can also have false ones out there who are promoting it at the top, because the elite also like to confuse the public. We found Erich von Däniken was promoted out there in the 70s to lead the whole generation round in circles and to prepare them for this phase with Chariots of the Gods and other books claiming visitations from space. And here's the proof of these Latin American rock carvings. And every major on the paper, on the planet, newspaper and television published this stuff and promoted it as though it was fact, which tells you there was an organized scheme of acceptance and promoting this at the top. There was no questions asked. That was the giveaway. Until one little reporter from England eventually went into Latin America, into Mexico, and he tracked down a little Mexican guy who was carving out these rock carvings for Erich von Däniken for a few pesos each. So Däniken wasn't only a very good con man, promoted from the top, mind you, but he's also very, very cheap. But that kept people going in circles and circles for a long time. It also opened up possibility thinking. Well, if that could be true, then this could be true. And then you end up going through a whole series of possible truths that could be, because you've allowed yourself to be trapped into a tunnel with a myriad of branches that come off it. It's called imagination. During World War II, when the US Navy and brought in airstrips into some of the Pacific islands and built these airstrips, in came a whole new culture, a different world to the native populations of those little islands. They suddenly had something called money there, and physical items that were manufactured that they'd never thought of or even knew existed. They had an abundance for the first time of different kinds of foods come in, so much so that they stopped working and hunting and fishing. When the US pulled out of those little countries, the people suddenly were devastated from this incredible plethora of goods they were generally just dispensed willy-nilly, thrown at them almost. And they were back to where they had been before the Navy had come in. They tried to rationalize it according to their religion, their old religions. And they came up and were called the cargo cults because they began cults thinking that if they just prayed to their old deities, these sky birds would come back in again and land with all the goods and give them all the goods that they'd had for a short time. They'd bring new stuff with them. They call them cargo cults. In desperation brings incredible, bizarre rationalizations. Again, according to what we previously believe, or have been taught or educated to believe. When the US Indian populations were being decimated by the cavalry, eventually, in some of the bands, they looked for their own form of Messiah. They'd already been tainted with the Christian religion because wherever, you see, the Christian religion was never a reality. I didn't say the message was never a reality. The religion was never a reality. The message was supposed to free individuals from what was a mass culture of rigid indoctrination. The religion, wherever the religion went, brought the system of commerce with it. Commerce, money, banking, wealth, and poverty. That's why wherever Christianity went from England, they made a big push towards sending out missionaries in the 1800s and the 1900s abroad. It was really to further the British Empire, because with it came a military behind them eventually to make sure that the system itself was imported, not just the actual New Testament. Therefore, native cultures had to start dressing up, not only dressing up, but dressing up the way that the missionaries dressed up. And they wouldn't be happy, those missionaries, until these new converts were carrying briefcases and short hair and talking facts and statistics and investments. That was called Christianity. It's a culture that was brought along, a system. That's why it's been so effective. And that is why whenever the military goes into a country to conquer, you find a plethora of missionaries are sent along with them to alter the culture into the same as the British or the American. There is no doubt that much of history, we know in fact that much of history is kept from the public. What history we're given is his story. You see, whoever writes it, who is authorized to write it. And there's more misleading goes on by the omission of facts than the addition of facts. If you have the omission of facts, you'll reach faulty conclusions. It's not a difficult technique to use upon people. Prior to the 1500s, historians were employed by the kings or the queens to write glowing histories on that king or queen. And they did it very happily, since they were well rewarded. And that's why every king and queen prior to the 1500s was wonderful, according to history. And yes, they might slaughter a few thousand here or a few thousand there, but on the whole, they were jolly good fellows. That's how it's written, you see. That's how that's rationalised. Because no one would turn in a bad history to someone who was employing them, who also had the ability to chop your head off. It wasn't until the 1700s we began to get a little bit more factual in the histories. But never completely factual. The same goes today with democracies which took over the governing part, at least the work part, of running countries. Authorized historians are always put out there. The main ones are given access to certain archives to bring out more facts which stun the general reader and the general population and become very popular. But there's always spins on it, because no one will ever come out and tell you the real truth. They wouldn't be authorized to do it. Author and authorized, it's no coincidence. What we boil down to is to look at what we see in life today. What do we see? Apart from the same system of money, power, and the misuse of it, and the domination of others, and the tragedy of collective societies where we're treated as a collective for a tax-based, for armies that slaughter on a much larger scale, always an ever-increasing larger scale, and that's only the type of conventional slaughter you see. You don't see the slaughter wrought by which are tainted, deliberately so, or through high-tech weaponry, which is silent. We can be sure it's getting worse all the time. And far from freeing us, science is killing us. This brings us always back to the crucial point, and that is the nature of evil itself.